All right, we're in the middle of this section, which starts in verse 2 on trials. And this particular Greek word for trial has three distinct meanings. Anybody remember any of them? Okay, it's the same word that we're going to come back to again in verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil. That's the same word that is used here. So one of the ways this word is used is the testing and the trying of one's fidelity to God, hoping what? What does the devil hope?
Failure.
That we'll fail. And so his tests are very sinister, very bad. In the book of Luke, as Jesus is going through the 40 days in the wilderness, and he's fasting, and the tempter comes and tempts him. Same word is here. But that's not the way it's being used here. And I made a pretty important point on that last week, and that is the term fall into. What's the inference of falling into something? The definition of that term was an accident, something that was unintended. And generally speaking, are temptations that lead to sin an accident? Can't be an accident, can they? Because what has to happen for you to sin? Okay, you have to be enticed, your lusts have to be activated, and then when the enticement and the lust conceive, then what happens? Then we fail the test, then we sin. So he's going to deal with that when we get to verse 13. These are things you fall into. So what kind of trials do we fall into? Well, there's two different kinds. There's the kinds that come from God. Does Hebrews 12 talk about chastening and about enduring chastening and about God trying to help us to grow? But do you know what they are? Something bad happens to me tomorrow. Do I look up and say, well, God, you're testing me again? No, I never do that. Because did he send me a letter? You know, I just can't say that enough. If God didn't send you a letter regarding this particular activity, then what had you better not do? Yeah, attribute it to him, because you don't know if it was him. Isn't that what got Job in trouble? Job's attributing things to God, and God says, I'm not involved in this. That's not what this is about at all. The conclusions that you have drawn are inappropriate. We really started all this back in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Why is everything vanity? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Who's responsible for that? We are. So the bottom line is, when somebody dies or when some terrible event occurs, they get in a terrible car accident, some health problem comes along, is it fair to say, God, why are you doing this to me? No, because where did it come from? But where does all of this come from ultimately? From Adam and Eve and sin, right? We made the choices. We are the ones who are responsible. And about the time we want to point the finger at Adam and Eve, what do we see pointing back at us? You see those fingers coming back. Because did we do any better? Paul says, I was alive apart from the law. When the commandment came, what happened to me? I did the same thing Eve did. And any of us do any better? No. So these trials, we have to be careful, because we don't know. It's just part of living in a sin-cursed world. When you live in a sin-cursed world where God is trying to save people and the normal rules don't apply, as the Ecclesiastes writer, I saw you, Virgil, I'll get you in a second. The Ecclesiastes writer put it like this. Sometimes what should happen to a righteous man happens to the wicked, and sometimes what should happen to the wicked happens to the righteous. And that's not fair, and it's skewed. And you remember the guy in the psalmist, Psalm 73, said, my feet had almost slipped. So trials are very dangerous. And there's a way that we're supposed to approach them, though, and that's what we're going to be talking about here in just a second. Virgil?
Yeah, I always looked at the term vanity in two different ways. One is, I think, as we're discussing right now. But the other way is that it's a term that is placed upon the worldly possessions that we have, or the world itself, that is basically vanity when it's compared to heaven, the spiritual part,
right,
that's worth going for. Actually, if we're we could be doing everything just right in a sense, but we're not putting the proper emphasis on the works of the flesh, or our jobs and all this other kind of stuff, in comparison to the amount of time that we spend as being a Christian, enhancing our knowledge and our ability to take and work with people and all that kind of stuff. Well, the previous one I'm talking about is vanity in comparison.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly what this passage is dealing with. When you don't feel joy and you have a trial, what's it telling you? You have the wrong attitude. You are still too closely tied to this world. When Job lost everything, what did he say? I came
naked.
I'm going to leave naked. Does any of this matter? Nope. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Was he still happy? Was he still content? Well, yeah, he was still talking properly because he was still thinking properly. Even after he lost his health and his wife said, curse God and gut and die, what does he say? You're speaking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not handle the bad things that come along in life? And I don't think at that point, matter of fact, I know he didn't, because it says in all this, Job did not charge God foolishly. He did not make any applications against God. So these kinds of trials are the ones that we fall into. Now, sometimes they come from God and sometimes they don't, but we will never know. And it really doesn't matter. If they came from God and they were needed for our chastening, should we be happy? If they just happen because we live in a sin-cursed world and they're going to make us more patient, should we be happy? So it doesn't really matter. Now, the ones from Satan we'll deal with in chapter 12. And he uses the same word. Blessed is the man who endures temptations, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. Let no one say when he is tempted. So it's interesting. I don't know why they do that, because it's the same Greek word in verse 2 as it is in verse 12. But they're using trial here and temptation there. And do those mean a little bit different to us when we see those two different terms? So the English likes to make an arbitrary distinction. They like to make the word temptation is always sinister. The word trial is more neutral. But it's the same Greek word throughout. So, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Now, we also talked about the word joy, and that is the word we reserve for the best days of our life. When it's your birthday, when it's your graduation day, when you've just gotten married, we gather our people together, we rejoice, we have a wonderful, enjoyable time together, and that's where we generally reserve joy. When Job's three friends came to him, did they come to have a party? No, they did not. But according to this verse, would it have been better if they had? Yeah, it would have come out a lot better. Ray? Yeah, some of the translations still have the temptation. Right, exactly. Because, let me just stay on track here then. So, my brethren, count it all joy, regardless of the type of trial. Various means different hues, different colors, different manifold, different varieties. So, and the reason why now focuses on this word knowing. So, there are some facts that need to be in our mind, and that's where we're at right now on the paper here. So we're done reviewing. I want to read that second definition of gnosko. It denotes, in ordinary Greek, the intelligent comprehension of an object or matter, whether this comes for the first time or comes afresh into the consideration of the one who grasps it. And so this has the idea of, and then the very last definition of the one up above, a discriminating apprehension of external impressions, a knowledge grounded in personal experience. So this is a deeper knowledge. Obviously, the first time you try to learn how to drive, do you have this kind of knowledge? No, you don't have the personal experience yet. You have the outward impressions, but over time, you gradually begin to get a comprehension and an understanding, and then you have this word knowledge, which is at least you have a discriminating apprehension. Now, again, whether it's for the first time or it's coming over and over again really isn't under consideration, But it basically is telling me I've got to have, every time a trial hits me, this is the first thing I need to think. And so this is something we all need to be looking at this evening, because what we need to know is that this is testing my faith. This is a test. So every trial is a test. And the term test here is a little bit different from the word trial. You can look at the definition here. Literally, it means to watch. Then it means to watch people who succeed. It was originally used of a battle where the general would be watching the men, and the ones who really stood out, they got this particular term given to them. So it has the idea of passing the test. This is a good test. If I get through this test, look at, again, some of the definitions here. Something which is tried or proved. Something that is reliable and trustworthy. Something that is testing and passing of the test. So as I enter the test, there's two paths. I can fail, I can pass. If I feel joy, I passed. If I don't feel joy, I didn't pass. So I know this is a test and God is watching me. Now, he's told me in many different places that trials are necessary. We spent a lot of time on this last week. Jesus said, "Blessed are you when men speak of you evilly, they cast out your name as evil, rejoice and shout for joy." See, he's already dealt with these things. James is just building on some of the things that Jesus has already said. We need to understand that covetousness and putting too much emphasis on this life, as Virgil said, is vanity. Even if I get through this life perfectly, I get my degrees, I accomplish everything, I die with every possible good thing accomplished, what's it going to matter on the judgment day? None of that will matter. And if I haven't grown and developed as a Christian, well, I need trials to grow and develop as a Christian. I don't need life to just be prosperous and everything to go well, because I can't grow under those circumstances. The Hebrew writer made that very clear when he said, we need to run with patience the race that is set before us. That's the same word as here. And so I need to know that this is a testing of my faith, which is to produce something. It is to accomplish something. So this is an event that I have to have a loss. It would be like the farmer. He goes out to his barn and he takes all the rest of the grain out of his barn. He's got nothing left. And so he takes that grain and he churns up the soil and he throws it all into the soil. Now, is he crying while he's putting it in the soil? No. Why? What does he know? It's got to go through this process. It's got to die. Like Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, grain has to die before it can produce. And so if I have the proper attitude, and farmers do, they're not throwing that crop away. They're investing it. And so when I go through these trials, I'm not losing something. I'm investing in it. It's like, you know, the 25-year-old is told you need to buy a life insurance policy. How many 25-year-olds want to buy a life insurance policy? Or start investing for their retirement. See, it's really, really difficult to get them to see that, because right now they're not interested in that. And it's the same thing with Christians. Christians are not always interested in these trials because they don't realize that it's these trials that are producing patience, and it is this patience which is producing perfection. So there's a step, there's the two-step process here. The trials that bring joy are creating patience, and patience is creating perfection. So if I look at it like that, if I look at a trial not as a terrible situation I'm going through, but as an investment, as a growing process, as something that is going to have great returns, then I can feel like Job, then I can feel like Paul. But if I'm that person in Matthew 6, who doesn't know where his food and clothing and shelter is going to come from, and then he loses something, then what's my attitude? Am I seeking first the kingdom and his righteousness? So what James is after here, and this is something we all need to think about, and we're kind of at a disadvantage here because as Christians, most of us, how many trials do we go through? Compared, say, to a country like Malawi where you're just about to harvest and a typhoon comes in and now you got nothing. So it is the trials that we do have, we really need to appreciate. But if you don't have them enough, then they seem like intrusions or nuisances or not a normal part of living. Virgil?
Yeah, I think a lot of that depends upon the field that we're in. If you're a farmer, you face that stuff all the time. If you're an auto mechanic, you have ups and downs trying to fix things. The fix eludes you, can't figure it out. If you, whatever you do, you're going to have problems. And I think that's a growth process in that area, is learning how to deal with it.
Right.
And being content with whatever you have.
And so we've prayed for years. We thank God that we can preach His Word without what? Without fear of persecution. But if we get that persecution, then we should be thanking God for the persecution.
Yeah.
But is that going to be as easy? Is it easier to thank God for not having trouble or for having trouble?
Thank you for it.
And so, but James is after something. And, you know, it's like I was saying, some passages have a lot more application in one generation than they do in another. Now, if, let's say, for example, in another 5 or 10 years, the rules in the country change and Christians become public enemy number one. And if it's known that you're a Christian, you're going to forfeit everything. You might even go to jail. Will this verse have a little more importance then than right now? But this is something we need to learn, because even though we don't have them as often as some people do, when we do have them, they can still be very dangerous. What did Jesus say about persecution and tribulation in the parable of the sower? What does it cause some people to do?
Weed it down.
Well, it's the rocky soil, right? The sun comes up. What happens? There's no root. So what happens to the plant?
It withers.
It withers. And so when tribulation or persecution arises from the word, it says straightway he falls. Straightway he stumbles. So, and those sometimes are our two choices. We're either going to fall away or we're going to get stronger. And so we need to know going in. We need to know before you have your next trial, God expects you to count all joy. Now, as I said last week, that's not going to happen immediately. You're going to have to go through the process of acceptance. And then, as you look back on it. But when we look back on our trials with bitterness, then we have a serious spiritual issue here, because it didn't produce what it was supposed to produce. We need to be able to look back on our trials, especially the ones that we handled ourselves well and the ones that we grew from, and be grateful to God that they occurred. George?
I don't believe the concept is as much to have joy that you actually had the trial as it is joy that in spite of that you have salvation. And I think we can decipher that from all that James says here, as well as other scriptures.
Well, I think if we were in Peter, I would use your line of reasoning in Peter, because Peter uses exactly the same terms. Let's look at 1 Peter chapter 1, and then we'll come back here. So 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6, it says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials," same two words as James uses, "that the genuineness of your faith," there's the word testing again, exactly the same Greek word, "being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to be praise, glory, and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love." And then he goes on to talk about in verse 9, the salvation of your soul. So yes, in this verse, if you look at the overwhelming or the overarching teaching, that would be true. But this is a little bit different. This is talking about our own personal growth and development, about our own personal patience and completeness and perfection and maturity. And he never even goes to salvation. He's focusing, the joy here is because the testing of your faith is producing patience, and the patience is having its perfect work so that you can be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And then if you lack the wisdom to be able to see this, ask God and He'll give it to you. So there should be a sense of accomplishment after each trial. So I wouldn't disagree with you, George, that the overarching goal here of salvation is what brings that about. But James is focusing here on each individual. It'd be like the runner who's setting goals. And as he reaches each goal, he's excited because he knows he's reaching toward whatever the overarching goal is, which in this case would be our salvation. But in order to get to our salvation, we've got to get through all of these tests. And there should be joy in the test itself. So I think they're both there. I really do. Now, did I see another hand back there? Andre?
At what point does the trial become counterproductive, though? If you experience the joy, but then it's something that happens to you daily, and then it kind of swings back to more of a destructive thought versus being joyous about the trial. At what point do you change directions?
Well, that's an interesting question. In some situations, for example, Job, could Job switch direction? No, see, he was locked in. He couldn't switch directions. His situations were fixed. How about Abraham taking his son to Mount Moriah? You know, it was pretty fixed. Other situations, yeah, if you can get out from under them, but as Paul says, sometimes it's better to use them rather than to get out from under them. But each one of us has to make those decisions regarding, can I get out of this and should I get out of this? Is this something that would help me ultimately, or is this something that's going to be counterproductive? But most trials, for example, persecutions over your faithfulness in the Lord, how are you going to get out from under them? See, so some things, your question would be a moot question, because a lot of the things that James is talking about here, you wouldn't find yourself in that kind of a situation. But if you find yourself in a situation of a trial that you don't feel like you can handle, and there's no spiritual components and no moral components, then you certainly have your own discretion as to what to do with that. Does that make sense?
Yes and no.
Well, ask again.
In terms of, like, when I talk to you about your job, that's like a necessary evil. You can't just... I mean, you'll experience things sometimes every day.
Oh, yeah.
A trial every day. But
right.
You have to be there, but at the same time, it becomes counterproductive. How do you find joy in it every day? The trial every day, how do you find joy in that?
Well, you find joy in that when you start seeing the patients start to develop. It can either be, you know, when a hamster's running in a cage, it can either be he's getting better and better and stronger, or he's getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And if you're in that rat race where you're going around and around and around, but you're finding yourself getting stronger and stronger and stronger as a Christian as you go through those things, then that would be something that would bring joy, because you can see yourself handling it properly. Yesterday I didn't do well, today I did better, tomorrow I did, you know, 2 weeks ago this would have bothered me, now it doesn't bother me at all, and 2 years ago I would have been ready to quit, and now I can laugh about it because it doesn't matter anymore. And if you're able to turn it around and make it into something that is helping you to grow and develop as a person, a lot of people don't have good bosses. Peter talks about bosses that are froward or scolios. They're twisted, they're perverted. They like making life miserable for people. And some people are stuck under a boss like that. Some can get out from under it, some can't. It depends on your financial obligations. You know, some people, they're just stuck. They have to stay in that situation. So at that point, I'm going to sit down with them and I'm going to try to start explaining to them, look, you can't get out from under this trial, but if you look at it, how do they put it? If you got a bunch of lemons, you make lemonade, and life is a bowl of cherries, but why do I always get
the pits?
So, I mean, there's always ways, different ways of looking at things. And so a lot of it has to do with perspective. We had that sermon a few months ago about Jesus. Here's Jesus in the garden, weeping and crying and strong cries. But what does Hebrews tell us he finally decides? Who for the joy that was set before him? Well, what happened? He's crying over here, but now he's got joy. What happened? Attitude.
Yeah.
He changed his attitude. He made a decision. I'm going to go through this. And once he made that decision, he went through it and he looked at it with joy. So it's just a really difficult question, you know, because it depends on the individual and what they're made of and what they can handle and how they can grow and whether or not this is something that is going to destroy them. Jesus does say, and there are some people, trials will destroy them. And so people like that wouldn't need to back out of them. But if you can find a way to start growing through them and looking at them differently one by one, then you might find that you could actually grow in this situation. But it's, okay, I got lots of hands here. Charles?
Okay. Now, you know, I think a lot of times, whatever condition that we're in, you know, we have to accept that fact, you know, at that particular time. Because we may be going through a period of time where we can't go any further. But who's to say that we can't, you know, eventually, you know, go to another level where we can find joy and everything. In other words, all of us go through something in life that we don't want to go through. But you know what? Those trials and things is what strengthen us. You know, what are you made of? What kind of mind would you have? You just going to give up? Or just what? And I think most of us, all of us should have the attitude right here. You know, we're going through things. I'm sure that there are probably people have gone through some things and maybe they didn't have enough food to eat at one time. You know, but you got through it. You're here today. I'll just give that as an example right now. Maybe there was something else that was pressing you or whatever, but look at where you are now. This is what God has done. He's brought you from point A to point B. So that's what we have to be.
Right.
Thankful for it. I mean, that's the way that I look at it.
Jack and then George. I'm not sure who was first, but I'm going to let Jack go first.
You know, the best example that I can think of, and I think of him quite often, is Job. And we can see there that Satan, given an opportunity, Satan is going to do whatever it takes, as many times as it takes, to break you down.
Yeah.
And the only thing you can do is stand firm. I mean, even farther on in James, we're told to stand against Satan, and he will flee from you. And, it is an opportunity for joy when and if you can finally overcome, but it's a terrible situation if you finally cave in and lose your soul.
Right. Well, and that's what this is in here for, so we don't end up in that situation. George?
Well, you used the word perspective, and that's the point, actually, I think I was getting at a while ago. But none of this will happen unless we have some end goal in mind. And in this case, James is talking about our end goal would be producing endurance, but if we don't have the right attitude, we'll never get there. And in order to really look for that benefit, we have to see what it's going to be worth to us.
Right, and that's where, of course, you go to your salvation. That's where you go to. See, we're kind of in a situation. We can't bring anything in. What are we going to take out? Nothing. What can we do to change the world? What is that which is crooked cannot be straightened. That which is lacking cannot be numbered. So we're in a difficult situation, but God says, rejoice, it's just temporary. And while you're going through it, here's opportunities for you to grow along the way. And I want you to look at your trials as an opportunity to grow. I want you to look at your trials as an opportunity to gain endurance and to be able to do more and more for me. Because that's really what endurance is all about, is giving God what is his due. And yeah, as I say, the end result is salvation. And that's got to be the overarching thing. But there ought to be, at least in the hearts of some of us, who want God to look at us and say, here's a man like Job, here's a man like David, here's a man like Daniel, here's somebody who's willing to work out his own salvation and really put forth the extra effort. And we want to be able to do that. And this is one of those opportunities where I can show God that I really love him, that I really respect him, because, you know, we talk big. Most Christians talk big. You know, if I did this, if somebody came up to me and put a gun to my head and said, "Will you renounce Jesus?" What do we all say? We'd never do that. But what about these smaller things? What about these trials and troubles? Can we rejoice when we're in these kind of situations? And if we can't, then we need to recognize, as he says, that's not perfection. That's not the perfect work that we're working toward. We know that the testing of faith produces patience. Now, the term patience is the word endurance or the word perseverance, and it simply means the ability to bear up, the ability to keep going when you don't want to keep going. And for each individual, there's a different threshold for that. And we watch these Olympic runners, and how much endurance do they have? See, it's incredible to watch these Olympic runners and their endurance. But were they born with that? No, they had to go through it. What's the only way to get endurance? To go through pain. No pain, no gain. You can't get endurance without going through pain. Do you need your hand up?
I do. They have to prepare to be able to handle that and to endure. And I'm wondering if the seven things that we add to our faith, part of that, the patience and godliness and what's the other one?
Virtue, knowledge, self-control.
All of those things. That's part of the preparation we need to do when dark days come, so that we can endure and we can handle these
right.
trials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's right. Charles?
Yeah, I was just looking at Philippians chapter 4, verse 11. Right there, where it says, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned whatsoever state I'm in, therefore be content. Verse 12 says, I know both how to be abased and I know how to be abound. Everywhere and in all things, I'm instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need right there. So Paul is dealing with a situation like that. He's just dealing with it. You know, whatever's happening right there with him, with us, we know how to use this right here, too, to help us go through these trials or these struggles.
Right, right. And I think what we're all struggling with is that this is a very big subject, just huge. And we all have little areas where we can, I mean, we had that yow, where we got that phone call, or we got that diagnosis, or we got that circumstance, or that situation, or we had that upbringing, and we all have these various trials. And so what God is telling us is, I understand in the world you're in that you're going to have all kinds of trials. Now, here's my advice to you. I want you to learn how to count it joy when you fall into them. And so this is going to be a process that we're all going to have to work through. And some of us are going to do it better than others. And some of us are going to move more quickly than others, just like athletes and just like everybody else who goes through trials and struggles. And a lot depends on what's within us, how much root we have within ourselves, how much ability we have to hold on to these things. But when these trials come, and they will come in every kind and every sort and every type, and it's all those things that still bring tears to our eyes when we remember them, or still bring this sense of hopelessness or this sense of anguish within our heart, and we have to learn, as Jesus did, to see the joy, to be able to say, okay, that was a terrible thing to go through, but I learned something from it, and now I'm going to focus on what I learned, and I'm going to forget the sting. I'm going to forget the sting, and I'm going to remember the experience. And so by doing that, I'm going to know that each one of these tests that I go through and the way I respond to it is going to produce this perseverance or this endurance, just like the Olympic runner, just like the Olympic whatever, who needs to develop their cardiovascular system. And again, there's only one way to do that, and that's to go through the pain. No pain, no gain. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. That's just how it is in every realm of life, and it's how it is in the spiritual realm. And so sometimes, instead of being sorry for ourselves, we need to buck up and we need to tell ourselves, I need to learn from this and I need to get out of it. And as Andre put it, sometimes you just have to say, you know, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to stop. I'm going to regroup, and then I'm going to start again in a different way and hopefully handle it better next time. There's more than one way to handle this. But most people don't have the option of saying, well, I think I'll just get out from under this and go into something else. And so that's why I answered the way I did. And you and I need to talk individually about some of this stuff. Virgil?
I hope that I can make myself understood. Basically, in life, there's two courses of action, no matter what comes to us. We're going to take and deal with it properly, and we're going to take and learn and grow by this, or we're going to wilt. One of the two.
Right.
And the worst position is not the one or the other, but the one in between where we waver. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. That is the most devastating thing in the mind of the human being, is not to be content and understand what it's all about and deal with it.
Right. No, that's right. And that's why I'm sure Paul had a real sense of joy to be able to say, I can be your example. I've learned how to be content in whatever state I am. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. How many of us can say that? Even though we've been alive for 70, 80 or more years. And so how many of us, like Paul, it wouldn't really matter what came tomorrow. I know how I would handle it because I've already learned all of these things along the way. And so that's where this is leading us. And that's why he says, let patience have its perfect work. In other words, faith will, this will bring you to perfection. If you allow this perseverance to grow and develop, then you'll become perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Now, we are well over. And there's no kids to come up, so this is great. I can just kind of watch Jason back there and keep teaching as long as I want. But we probably should go ahead and stop now. So we'll pick up. Unfortunately, we only got another verse again. That's all right. We'll pick up in verse 4 next week, and that's how it's going to go, and that's all right. This is important stuff, and we're all having to struggle with it. So let's go through it. One step at a time. All right. Appreciate it. Thank you.